Hey, everybody. Thanks for listening to Shop Talk Show. We have two excellent sponsors this week. One, a first-time sponsor, Ding.io. Go to Ding.io/ShopTalk. It is time tracking for people running their own show. Use coupon code SHOPTALK for 3 months free. We'll talk about that later in the show. And the Artifact Conference that Dave's going to be at in Providence, Rhode Island, coming up here. We'll tell you all about how awesome that's going to be later in the show. But for now, let's kick things off.
Hello, dear listener. You're listening to another episode of the Shop Talk Show, a podcast all about the front end of web design. I'm trying new stuff. I'm Dave Ruffer. Hey, Chris.
Hi, Dave. It's about front end, but we're gonna extend our bounds this week a little bit.
It's getting contenty.
Indeed, today. We have Karen McGrain with us. Thanks you for joining us, Karen.
Hello.
Did we warn you about the sound effects? Because if we didn't, there's going to be a lot of them.
I would expect nothing less.
Okay, good. I am just fresh back from the CSS DevConf, which is also an Environments for Humans event, but it was a real in-person thing, and it was in Estes Park, Colorado, and it was very beautiful, and I just feel like mentioning it because I'm just fresh back, and it was lots of fun. It was an incredibly beautiful town. It's way up in the Rocky Mountains, so you can't even look outside without it being beautiful. And I know a little something about beautiful towns, actually, because Karen and I did some time in New Zealand at once, and we were in towns like Queenstown, which was ridiculously beautiful.
Chris and I spent an entire week in a car together driving around New Zealand.
We did that. It was not even a year ago.
It was fun.
It was. Mm-hmm. I talked to some people recently who were going for the first time this year, and I just was struck with jealousy.
I have been telling everybody, like, I travel a lot, and mm-hmm. I don't normally come back from places and grab people by the lapels and shake them and say, no, you have to go there. You have to go. But New Zealand, you got to go there. Like, you have to.
I agree. It was incredible. And remember Queenstown? I feel like that was one of the more beautiful ones because it's kind of remote and it has like the big gondola thing that goes up. And it's one of those towns where you can't even step outside without being like, what?
Like, what is this insanely beautiful place? Yeah, I would tell people to fly in and then like fly direct to Queenstown and spend a couple days there. Then
yeah,
go
we had it all figured out, of course, at the end.
Right.
Our strategy was okay, but we did the Not to make anybody mad who lives in Christchurch, but we started there, and you know, you're in there kind of a rebuilding phase right now, and it didn't have us as excited as some of the other towns there.
I'm glad I got to see it though, to see that kind of earthquake damage up close and personal, like.
Yeah, makes you feel extra sympathetic about that situation.
Yeah.
Holy cow, can it screw up a town? And you know what? I got to see not to be like, oh, cool. I got to see more death. But there was so much
New
flooding.
Zealand death tours.
In Colorado they had all the flooding, which I was recently at a wedding, and the whole ranch that I was at, which we stayed at, and it was very beautiful in Colorado, is totally gone.
Whoa.
Of the thing. And we were taking our shuttle up to Estes Park, and there's this mountain, and there's this huge like brown strip up the mountain. And our cab driver goes to us, you see that mudslide coming down there? That wasn't there 2 months ago. I mean, it looks like such a huge thing that there's like no way this was formed in a couple of nights or whatever, but it totally was. It's incredible the damage. Our cab driver is living in a hotel because he can't even get to his house. It's messed up there. Anyway, that has nothing to do with the web.
Hey.
We're here to talk about that a little bit. Karen is known for content strategy, as it were, and possibly more specifically content strategy across this world of devices that we're in now. Is that fair?
Y'all had to like get really attached to your phones and then, oh snap, how do we put things on them?
Yeah. So you have a book all about it, right?
I wrote a book about it's not about how you publish to mobile specifically. It's more, hey, what happens when we now have to acknowledge, like, what is it? What has been true all along, but now we really have to look it in the face and go, oh, we don't have any control over what size screen somebody has or how much bandwidth they have or what kind of input mechanism they're using. Like, we don't have any control over that. So what do you
literally
do?
None.
None whatsoever. And you see people still clinging to this illusion of like, oh, but no, really, I can imagine that this is just like a piece of paper. It's just maybe like a smaller piece of paper, but I still have the same control like I did with a piece of paper, right? But no.
Wow. Yeah, and you see that all the time, because part of what you get to do is work for companies who are like in the middle of this transition, and you get to see the kind of the attitudes that permeate it.
Yeah, I describe it as like step one, companies are like, oh, hey, we need a mobile website. And step two is like, hey, I know, let's use responsive web design. And step three is, oh, man, we got
is
a
that,
lot
those
more
Those are
problems.
The three stages.
Those are the straight three stages, yeah. And so it's like when they hit step three, that's when they want to talk to me, because it's like, oh, we got to fix so much other stuff. Like, we thought responsive design was just going to be this magic wand we could like wave over the front end of our website and it would make everything all squishy and then all our problems would be solved. But in fact,
where did that come from? Ethan never said that, right? And nobody's ever said that. It just, how did that come to be?
I think mobile is so hard. And I think so many companies have been kind of sitting on their hands for a while, like going, do, 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 do. Well, we can't possibly make any decisions about this. Let's just wait around and see what happens. And then one day they looked at their traffic and it was like 40, 50% of their traffic is coming from mobile devices. And they went, oh my God, we got to do something about this. And so they just wanted to buy into this magical thinking that responsive web design was the answer. Like, they could just take their existing website, their existing infrastructure, their existing people, and like make it squishy, and then all their problems would be solved. And
it was the desire for a
solution.
I made a Photoshop action that does just this. It's called Magic RWD, and it will take any website and instantly make it mobile.
And so
a lot of the problems come in with the content, where it's like, you think you can start with your existing stuff and then just kind of reorganize it or squish it down or something. But in fact, no, you wind up having to rewrite or restructure all of what you are saying.
What are some of the big gotchas for content? Just if you're trying to, I don't know, let's say AT&T or somebody called me tomorrow and they're like, hey, I need a new website. What are their gotchas? Like, what would be the big problems you've seen?
Sure. So hypothetically, if AT&T were to have called me, they
didn't you? Okay,
they
keep going.
So one of the big problems is that they would be looking at their desktop website and say, you know, a lot of what's on here might be kind of crappy. Like, the generous real estate afforded by the desktop screen has allowed us to just put a lot of stuff on there and not necessarily have to answer tough questions about whether it's really providing value. And then beyond that, like, I think a lot of corporate websites, AT&T, for example, they suffer from what I call blobitis, which is that they have been treating the desktop web as if it's like a big piece of paper. And so when you go in and you look at all the layouts, they have all of the content sort of, you know, carefully laid out on the screen, you know, images and text juxtaposed with all sorts of different styles. And all of that content is, you know, even if they have a content management system, like, what they probably have in that CMS is like one giant box, and then they've dumped a bunch of HTML in that box. And so now when they want to go back out and say, oh, right, but, you know, this headline or this chunk of content or this image, we want to treat it differently on mobile, or we want to break it down in a different way, it's pretty hard to get back in there and pull out the meaty, the creamy center of the content, because it's all wrapped up in the hard candy shell of the formatting in HTML. Mm. And beyond that, you know, AT&T is a great example because they, like, when you talk about responsive design, and I think so many of us buy into this model of saying, let's just serve the same content to everybody. And that we all need to start there. That should just be the foundation of what we do to keep ourselves sane on mobile. But AT&T will come back with some justifiable business reasons for saying, yeah, but wait a minute. We have support content that is, in fact, actually directed to specific devices. So we need a way to target content by platform. Like, we want you to be able to get content about your Android device that is different from content that we would have about mobile device or iOS devices. Oh,
interesting.
So how do we do that?
Yeah. Well,
yeah.
That's interesting. But in general, you're a fan of serve the same content to everybody.
Oh, God.
Unless there's like a specific
use. Yeah. You know, I try to be really clear with everybody where I'm like, I think responsive will work for what, 80, 90% of what you need to serve? Like, I think in most cases, you should be able to go in, clean up your content, fix your pages, figure out what the right experience should be, use it as a catalyst to force you to write better content, to clean up the garbage, and that's going to, you know, the discipline that is afforded by making you treat, making you use responsive to send the same content to every device is actually healthy. But if you come back to me and you're like 10 to 20% of what we need to serve, we have to target it in some way. It has to be custom to a device. I my job is to help them solve that problem too. And it's not cheating. It's in fact recognizing that there are justifiable business reasons in certain limited circumstances where they must do that.
Sure. And if that's the case, there is like third party user agent detection stuff that keeps super up to date and whatever that you could probably potentially use for that type of thing if people are curious. So you were saying the opposite of that responsive web design isn't an answer. It clearly is an answer. It's just a part of an answer.
Yeah, I think that the idea that we will be using responsive and adaptive techniques together is probably to me, that's one of the most powerful things that we should start talking about. And it's not like, to me, it's not like client-side and server-side solutions are like in this pitched battle to see who's going to win. It's that if we're going to figure out, if we're going to survive this wave of all these crazy devices, we need every tactic in our arsenal possible. And the real question comes down to where are you spending your efforts? Like, if you look across both the development team and the editorial team, and you look short-term and long-term, all of these things are going to have a cost associated with them. Like, in some cases, it's more efficient to put more energy into development upfront because your maintenance costs are going to be lower. In some cases, it's the opposite. In some cases, you might say, let's do something simpler upfront and accept that we're going to have to maintain more versions long-term, or accept that our editorial team is going to have to be doing more work long-term. And those questions, those are not questions with super obvious, like, dogmatic answers. Those are questions that you really have to sit down and work through what makes sense for the team, what makes sense for the organization.
Mm-hmm. I like the idea of all these solutions having to come together. It's like that classic movie construct where like two nemesises need to work together to fight a common enemy. You know, not that anybody should be considered an enemy, but if the enemy is trying to, I don't know, support every device you can, we're just going to all have to work together.
Russians and Americans.
I know. I was
getting together.
Robots fighting aliens coming from under the sea.
This doesn't work.
So it's another part of the solution ends up typically at the CMS level. Yeah.
Yeah.
Can we get that thing into shape too? I'm sure you've worked with people in which that had to happen. Yeah. Is it often an overhaul, or how does the CMS have to do with all this?
So in many cases, I find that organizations have a content management system, have infrastructure that actually really only supports publishing to the desktop web. I think, or maybe another way to say that is that doesn't actually support true multi-channel publishing. that would enable them to target content by platform or, you know, through whatever other characteristics they might want to tailor those messages. And, you know, I talked about this at a conference once, and some guy like raised his hand, and you could just see this look of bewilderment on his face. And he's like, but isn't that why I have a CMS? And you gotta look at it as, for, you know, up until this point, we didn't need the CMS to publish to anything other than the desktop. Like, it's sort of like somebody raising their hand and being like, well, isn't the whole point of having a car that it should drive on the water? And it's like, well, no, we pretty much only designed that car to drive on roads. The idea that you want it to drive on water now is actually this whole other crazy thing we haven't had to figure out yet. So there are larger enterprise platforms, component CMSs, they're often called, that because they were designed to support publishing to both print and web, that can handle this kind of stuff. But for a lot of people with like web, I call them web publishing tools, they're not actually a true CMS in the sense of managing granular content to be targeted to different pages or different platforms. They are essentially like something that facilitates you making a web page and then putting it out there.
Kind of like Dreamweavers.
Yeah, you know, it's like, I have nothing against WordPress. I use it myself, but blogging systems being used for content management, like, in one sense, they moved publishing ahead by a decade in that they enabled more people to get stuff on the internet, but they set structured content back by a decade because we decided that, oh, you know what the easiest possible thing is just give people a big blob. We'll just give them one giant box and we'll tell them content goes here and you can stuff whatever you want in that box. And unfortunately, if you're then trying to get that content now onto different sized screens, or, you know, you want to target chunks of content in different ways, you don't have the right structure embedded in that CMS to make that happen. And so I think for a lot of organizations, the oh snap moment where they realize what mobile really entails also entails making possibly replatforming their CMS, in many cases most certainly developing an API strategy for how they're going to get stuff out of their legacy systems. And in many cases, it means going back into all their crappy desktop content, cleaning it up, sorting it into boxes, and creating more richly defined structure, more fields in that content in their CMS.
Right. And certainly, so just because people are saying this stuff and I've talked about it in the past too, is that something like WordPress, it absolutely is what you describe it as, out of the box, right? It has the title and then the blob, just one giant thing you can paste things in. And those of us who are developers and work with WordPress are like, no, of course WordPress can do more than that. There's plugins to make it better. There's custom fields. There's custom post types, yada, yada. You can make this thing into the most perfect CMS you've ever seen. I could make a box for AT&T that had a box for serve this information to Android devices and serve this. I could do that, but the fact that it's not like that out of the box had an enormous influence on how people used it in the past, right?
Yeah, I can see people like, you know, bouncing up and down in their seats and being like, no, WordPress has custom fields. I mean, trust me, I'm fully aware of that. Speaking as a content strategist, the problem here is not the technology. Okay, I'm not picking on WordPress. I'm not picking on anything. What I'm saying is that for many organizations, they have never sat down and done the content modeling work to be able to define what those fields should be. How do they want that content to work? And honestly, like I sometimes find that in as being an advocate for content strategy, developers who are doing that kind of implementation can sometimes be your best friend, because they're the ones that are kind of left holding the bag going, so do you want this broken into shop? What should I be doing in the CMS here? And so for a content strategist to come in and sit down and have the conversations about, hey, all this marketing content that you're publishing, like, let's try to impose some structure on it. Let's try to figure out, like, underneath all of that styling and that layout that you're trying to impose, like, what does that actually mean? And that work then makes the, you know, it makes everybody's job easier because that the implementation work on the CMS goes more smoothly and people then can do more with their content over the long term.
Is that, and you do that. You, if you worked with a company, you'd literally help them through that. How are we, can we decide on a structure?
Yes. So,
and do you find that rewarding? I don't know. I'm imagining that being like pretty rewarding, that part.
It's actually a lot of fun, and I think it's really powerful to sit down and talk to companies about what is it that they think that they publish and why. And oftentimes they can be quite articulate about, oh, right, like we have these content types and we think the content types have these attributes and we would like to we might want to use these things, these bits of content in this way. And from that, then I always describe it as like, I'm going to sit down and I'm going to do a content modeling process with the client, which is really just me talking to them about what it is that they want to do and why. And then there is still a separate data modeling exercise activity in which the database architect, the developers sit down and figure out how do we actually translate that to how the database is going to be structured and how do those interfaces then get expressed. And I think too often that always gets treated as like one task. Like, you know, you just sit down and it's like, okay, I got to make a database here. So I'm going to make a database and then I'm going to put some fields on the screen and then those fields are going to match up to my database and whoop, that whole CMS UX problem is solved. In fact, those are three very different activities. The content modeling is not the data modeling and the data modeling is not the CMS interface design.
Interesting. And do you get like, I mean, because... Would you get pushback from that if you're like, well, here we're going to need some new, even if you're like come up with the concept that they're going to need to break up data into these smaller chunks? Are they like, well, our CMS isn't ready for that? Or do you have to just be like, well, you're going to have to make it ready for that? I mean, if they're not willing to do that, what can you do for them?
Right. I think no one calls me if they aren't ready for that. You know, sure. it's almost like a form of self-selection where I think I talk about this stuff publicly enough, but then once somebody figures out that they have this problem, then they want to have me come in and talk about it. Or very, very, very commonly, I wind up doing work with organizations where somebody will bring me in because they'll say, we get everything you're saying and we totally have this problem and we need you to come in and explain it to our executives or to the people who have never thought about it this way. Like sometimes it's kind of nice to have an outsider come in and be like, look, we found this woman on the street and she's saying the same things we've been saying to you for years. Will you believe her?
Huh. Right. That works out.
Sometimes that's it, huh? You're called in to confirm internal voices. Sometimes.
Very much so.
The role of a consultant.
Yeah, very much so. I think usually there's always advocates it's like there's often advocates in the development team. There's often advocates even, you know, in the content team where they recognize that they need more structured content and they might have been beating that drum for a while and having somebody from the outside come in who can be like, look, I've seen how lots of companies have solved this problem, and I'm telling you, this is the way it gets done. It helps.
If you're just tuning in, folks, we have Karen McGrain, at Karen McGrain on Twitter. Yeah, the content strategist, Bond Art something?
Bond Art and Science.
That's who you would call. That's your business entity.
That is my legal entity under which I do business.
Yeah.
That is epic. I love it. I love it. So guys, guess what? We have to talk about some drama. Quite a bit of drama went down this week. Chris, this one on Front End Architecture Showdown.
I put that one in here just because I thought it was pretty interesting because there happened to be that one day where there was an article posted called like CSS Cargo Cult something something that was
yeah.
And then there was the theory Koblenz article on Smashing Magazine. They both it was basically about what names should you use for your classes, and they both had very different opinions about how that should go down. It just was interesting that they're both kind of basically published on the same day, and so people were kind of linking to them together. And I did the same thing because it was pretty interesting. I don't do really what either one of them did. And then I thought it was interesting that Jeremy Keith had an article that was like, how about both? Which I'm not, I thought that was an interesting approach too. I would probably not do either or both, but my own thing. So maybe I'll write an article about it too. Anyway, I'll link up all those articles in the show notes. I don't know if we want to spend too much time on that. Unless
all right. We can skip it. I want to talk about this one. This one kind of came up, but does our industry have a drinking problem? And that was over at A List Apart.
Right, which has something to do with an event apart, and both Karen and I spoke at one of those in Austin and saw you, Dave, not at the conference, but while we were in Austin.
I was hanging out.
And okay, so we saw you at a Dribbble meetup that was at a bar. The meetup thingy in between the 2 days at an event apart was at a bar. Does our industry have a drinking problem?
Yeah, I don't know. Karen, what do you think?
You even want to go there?
There's a lot of drinking.
Yeah.
But I don't know if... I guess... Is that industry specific? I would imagine...
No.
That any...
No way.
Anytime people are going to conferences or events that there's drinking.
Well, I said the same thing. I was like, surely this is everything. And then my coworker Reagan was like, well, my wife is a dermatologist and she doesn't get totally smashed at their conferences. And I was like, oh, shucks.
I would think that some, like, I don't know.
The occasional one might. That might be.
I absolutely promise you it's not industry specific.
It's just interesting. It does kind of bring the question, like, every night we go to a bar, you know, there are underage people at the conference, you know, and so maybe they get excluded. Should there be other things? What should we do? But it's tough, you know. It's like having everyone go on a 5K run isn't quite as enjoyable or whatever.
That's almost more exclusionary. Way less True. People will sign up for that 5K than will go to a bar because I literally can't run 3. Whatever miles, and I know you can walk it too, but then that just feels weird. I don't know. Not that I would like be mad if there was a 5K meetup. I'd be like, heck yeah, go run, have fun. But I feel like the place that we choose to have the thing where we send the people in between the nights at a conference should be somewhere with like chairs and some kind of food and beverages. And then if you do that, you know, why not just have it at a bar? They're all over the place. They're useful. Nobody's jamming booze down your throat while you're at it. There's plenty of people just talking and sitting around. You can order a cranberry juice. I don't know. I don't think it's that big of a deal. Anyway, it's worth talking about though. And I think it was Rachel Andrews' article, right? Who's awesome.
Yeah, yeah. Rachel Andrews.
Who's totally awesome. And
I think it's a good point. I don't think she's like condemning anyone or anything. She's just very like,
yeah, let's talk about
hey, why are we so drunk?
You know, I've been working in this field since I'm 95 probably. And, you know, certainly got my first real professional job in 97. And, you know, you look at that at the age of this field and we're kind of in our awkward teen years. Like, we've matured enough that people can start talking about the industry, having meta conversations about the industry. Like, how do we treat each other? Like, you know, how are we behaving? And I think having those kind of conversations, not just about the technical side of what we do, but actually looking at our community and our industry and the people and our values is really important. So I'm always happy when people raise these kind of awkward teen issues that will help us grow as a profession. But I don't think it necessarily has to be negative. You know, like, I don't think it has to be this like finger pointing, like you guys are all a bunch of losers, because we're just maturing.
That's a good sentiment. Very mature. Wide scope. What else do you got, Dave?
Well, I was going to say my coworker Trent Walton posted a post on scroll hijacking, condemning,
which is different than like parallax, because in parallax you still just scroll down at a natural rate and things just happen to happen as you scroll down the page, and people kind of are starting to ubiquitously hate that too, just because it's unexpected and they tend to be heavier pages when that's the case. And I'm sure there's some other reasons too, but scroll hijacking is slightly different, and it's like scroll down a little bit and then it, like, the page just decides that you should be on page two now, and it just kind of snaps into place on page two. Isn't that the kind of the deal?
Yeah. And then all of a sudden you're like driving a sideways whatever carousel when, even though you're scrolling down, or you're like, it's kind of like anytime a website, or usually it's like these marketing sites, right? Like they try to make these really epic websites about a taco, right? And then so you're sliding through, and then as you scroll, like lettuce is being lowered into the taco, and then, you know, sour cream is being drizzled on, you know, it's just like this kind of like, I think the whole thing is like, it's supposed to feel epic, right? But you're just scrolling and you're like, what on earth? It takes 40 minutes to make a taco, apparently. I don't know what's going on. So, I think Trent has a very good sentiment, in there, just talking about like these are, I guess, immersive, but is it like, should we from a puritanical sense, should we be hijacking mouse scroll? That's kind of the
question.
Is it happened so much that we need
to have an intervention at this point, or is it?
Well, if you look at Apple, yeah, all of their like mini sites now are this, and Apple historically has been a huge trendsetter for the web, right?
I'd see that.
Because every client wants apple.com. Fact. please do give me apple.com. I don't know. I think it's very interesting to consider. I personally am not a super fan because, I don't know, I just like to cruise through websites as fast as I can.
Sure. You know? And on the large scale, nobody's gonna, I don't know, I don't, it's not like we're gonna I don't know, ATT is going to start doing it on our bill page. You know, I feel like these things are like people are trying to make an experience on the web, and then they do that. But it will never be. There's not going to be like blog posts that start doing this, I would think. I just don't think there's all that much to worry about. Maybe the apple.com is a little concerning because people are going to copy that or something in a way that they did. But I just kind of doubt that this is going to become like a major problem.
Mm-hmm.
That's all I got.
Mm-hmm. I don't know.
So we have some.
Karen, did you have an opinion?
Scroll jacking.
You know, I think having seen all kinds of trends like this, like, you know, there's a huge flashpoint. Everybody does it that way. Then everybody gets sick of it. People take it off. Mm-hmm. You know, with the perspective of history, I tend not to get too twitchy about this kind of stuff because it seems like the web is pretty self-correcting. Like, people do something that's super annoying, and then everybody bitches about it, and then we stop doing annoying things. That's how you learn.
Mm-hmm. That's good. Self-correcting internet. I like it.
Should we get to some questions? People have written in. They want to hear what we have to say. We should do a sponsor first, though, if I may. This is a brand new sponsor to us, ding.io. So ding.io. Go to ding.io/shoptalk so that they know they came from here. It's time tracking for people who run their own show. It's a super fast website. It's a fast iPhone app that goes with it. They're all synced together. It's really nice. It's super nice UI. If anything, just go to ding.io just to look at the really nice dashboard that they have built. I think that looks good. It has really simple pricing. It's $10 a month if you're just a person time tracking your own time, which that can be useful, of course, if you're a freelancer because you need to charge for your own time. But even not, I've actually run into some people, and I might start doing it too. And so the other guys on my team do this. They kind of, I'm not sure if they're time tracking, but they're like writing down very clearly what they do throughout the day just to give your own sense of personal accountability, which is pretty interesting. And if you're a team, it's $25 a month on Ding.io. So it's really straightforward pricing. You can try it out for 3 months, literally 90-day free trial, if you use the code SHOPTALK while you check out. So check out their beautiful UI and dead simple time tracking at ding.io/shoptalk.
Pretty awesome. It looks really handsome if you go to the website. So let's jump into some Q and A, the meat and potatoes on the Shop Talk show. This first one is an audio question from Mike Felden.
Hey, Chris and Dave. With all the talk right now surrounding responsive web design and making things look great on a smaller device such as your phone, why does nobody make their websites look good on a larger monitor? I have a 27-inch iMac, and my browser window is usually bigger than most people on a standard monitor. But why does the text not size properly and the middle column always stay the same size? So my question is, why do people focus on making it look great for a phone but not that experience on a larger monitor? Thanks. Enjoy the show.
All right, Karen, any thoughts, content strategy maybe for...
It goes bigger instead of smaller.
Giganto screens.
So I think I often describe this as you start to see how the idea that we keep the container of the page exactly the same as you might go from the smallest smartphone screen all the way up through the largest desktop screen all the way up through your smart TV, that, you know, one of the limitations, or one of the foundations of responsive design, is that page container stays the same. And so it does raise some content strategy questions of, okay, so how much can I put on a page such that the experience of scrolling on a mobile device doesn't take so long that no one's ever going to see no one's ever going to bother scrolling past a certain point, and that you have enough stuff to appropriately fill up a larger size screen. And that's actually a tough problem. Or I guess the way I would describe it is, you want to be able to make good decisions about the depth and the amount of information that you put on a page, on a screen, and that might wind up being different depending on the device that you have. And that kind of goes against our most deeply held values of serve the same content to everybody. But it's not that you would necessarily not, you would still want to serve the same content, but you might want to break it up differently. And so then now we're all back to my structured content and your CMS problem. Mm-hmm. But beyond that, I think the reason that so many people are freaking out about mobile is that they're looking at the traffic that they're getting from mobile devices and finding out that 40-50% of their traffic is coming from these smaller screens, and that they're not providing a good enough experience there. That, you know, that the site looks, you know, this site is painful to navigate. It's like trying to read a newspaper through a toilet paper tube. Whereas if you've got a 27-inch monitor, like, you, it may not be the optimal experience if you wanted to take advantage of all that space, but your experience isn't really hindered by that.
Right. You still got a mouse. Your face is right in front of it. You can still read. It's not a disaster like it can be on mobile. It's just there's some white space on the outsides. You know, you're like, not so bad.
And you can resize your window. I kind of look at it, and it's kind of like a rich white person problem. And so, like, my monitor's too large, man.
Yeah, right.
But I hear what he's saying. It's like, why don't we do more creative stuff with all that extra real estate if we're being truly responsive? And for me, it's always come down to, like, information density. Like, what can people, like, ingest? You know, I could start popping up, you know, all my, whatchamacallit, all my widgets, and I could, you know, pull my footer and I could put it out on the side in a bunch of columns or whatever. But, you know, does that then take away from the article because somebody's focus is totally lost because they have all these widgets and stuff on the side? That's the question. Like, Chris, on CSS Tricks, you could, like, add 100 more ads in the side, you know.
Right. I'm looking at the ding.io homepage, and there's like big swaths of white space on either side over there. But it just, you know, it still looks very clean and readable and usable. Like, should they just, oh, they detect that there's some room available and just beef up the font sizes super big? It just, you know, bigger doesn't mean more readable in every case. I think Karen actually answered it, and we're just reiterating what she said a bunch of times.
Smart answer.
Yeah.
I think it's, I would like to see examples of where it's done really well. There's this site called Breaking News, I think. I'm totally using the internet on the radio here. Breakingnews.com. It's like a responsive site, and then they kind of like start popping stuff up as you get wider and there's more real estate. And I'm very interested to like see how this tests compared to something very linear and easy, like, or very simple. You know, is this more eye tracking? Is this more, you know, tough stuff? I don't know. But it looks great and it performs well, but I just wonder if it is better for the reader. That's my only question.
That is the million-dollar question.
Yeah. All right. Cool.
Chris? Yeah. This is interesting. I think you should play the one by Forrest Tanaka.
Okay. Let me cue it up.
Hi, Chris. Hi, Dave. You had a question last week about Google punishing non-mobile optimized websites. I'd heard this, but I can't find anywhere Google themselves ever said this. A lot of blog posts that say this point to the Google Webmaster Central blog post called Changes in Rankings of Smartphone Search Results. But that post never says anything even close to punishing non-mobile optimized websites. It doesn't even make sense to me for Google's bot to examine CSS files to see if they use, you know, percentage widths and media queries, and mobile-friendly sites may not even use these anyway. So what are your thoughts? Have you really heard Google say that they'll punish non-mobile optimized sites? I think it's likely a myth, and maybe people think Google should do this, so any post they see from Google with the word mobile in it just confirms their belief. But I've been very wrong about a ton of things, and maybe you can show me where I'm wrong here. So thanks a lot. Truly, truly enjoy the show.
All right. So he's calling me out, huh?
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't last week. I don't remember when we talked about this or mentioned this, but I think has anybody actually noticed this? Can we think of any things? Karen, have you had like clients that say like our search engine traffic has dropped a whole bunch after some changes, and we need you to help us because of this? Is there any truth to losing Google juice, as it were, because of your mobile strategy?
I think there's a lot of mythology and perhaps even magical thinking that goes into search.
Yeah.
I don't think anybody really knows, and I think there's a lot of people who would happily make money off of telling you that you should freak out. So
yeah, that's interesting. Like, the Google is so tight-lipped about this, which actually fuels this SEO industry kind of.
Yeah. I am really fascinated with what changes Google will have to make to support mobile devices. I mean, you can see why. It's like, I think there's probably no organization out there that is more tightly attached to the idea of a web page, like the concept of a page. And that's what they're indexing, is a page. And when I talk about adaptive content and the idea that you need systems that will allow you to store more granular chunks of content and then serve those up dynamically to different platforms, that really actually starts to mess with Google. One example I like to use is, okay, so let's say hypothetically you decided that you wanted to have a desktop website, a mobile website, and then you decided that you wanted to send all of your content into separate templates for Google Glass. Like, I'm not saying you should do this, but hypothetically, you might. That is one thing that you could possibly do. Like, Google released their UI specs for Glass. Like, they've got some templates that they want you to use so things render appropriately. Cool. So how do you handle that? Google doesn't like it if you serve the same content in three different templates and have that all show up in search results. So you set one up. You set the desktop as canonical, right? Like that's the main one that they should be looking at. Okay, mm-hmm. cool. So did Google just make a platform that it can't search? Or did they just cost – I mean, are they saying, yeah, the best way for you to allow somebody to search Google Glass is to search the desktop and then send them over to the Glass version, redirect them to the Glass version?
Or maybe it can tell that your search originated on a Google Glass and will serve you different search results that are, you know, targeted.
Yeah, so this is – but it's like Google on the one hand is saying they don't they want you to put that canonical link on the desktop because they don't want to have to index three different versions.
Right, that would be too hard.
But yet they do, because one of them's theirs.
Yeah. Yeah, indeed. That is pretty interesting. And so, you know, and certainly to keep things fast and practical for them, they don't – and maybe they – I mean, I'm just saying they don't, like, with quotes around it. Like index it once with a normal UA string. Then, like, index it a bunch of other times changing the UA string just to see what they get. And maybe it's different. And then do it again by sending different client hints, you know, just in case that thing – get people used. And then, I don't know, maybe set some cookies and stuff. Maybe use some weird git parameters and see what they get. And see if, you know, they can't, there's infinite permutations of that. They can't index your site infinite times. You know, ideally they're doing it once, which is that idea of canonical, right?
Well, so there is a blog post from 2012, June 2012, and it's basically recommendations for building smartphone optimized websites, and Google sends the Googlebot goes to your site, and then it has a Googlebot mobile that also tracks your site. It also crawls through your site. So I don't know if they're doing any like parity matching or whatever, but they're sending two bots to your site, and maybe they're averaging out those things. I don't know. But on here, it's like they're recommending that you have a site specifically for that targets mobile devices, and they specifically recommend responsive web design. So maybe I don't know what I said there. Maybe I did say they're punishing, but I don't know what Google does, but I think they are like, if Google writes a recommendation, it's kind of like a wink, like you guys should probably use this. And then I think somebody in the chat room just posted a link where Matt Cutts, he's like the SEO dude there over at the Goog, and he said that not mobile friendly websites will see a negative impact in their rankings in mobile search results. So maybe that's just mobile to mobile. Who knows? But if you think about what Karen's saying, 40% of traffic is mobile, that mobile to mobile really starts to matter. So.
I'm sure they'll update their world, hopefully.
Yeah. I don't think it's like a penalty, but it's not a reward, if that makes sense. So maybe I'm just clarifying my statement.
I feel like we could use it the more you know sound effect. I like donut charts. I think they're super accidental button push. Dave right. Coleman asks, I work for a small traditional advertising and marketing agency who are just getting their digital (parentheses, that's what we call it) department off the ground. Our current process is to provide a technical specification along with wireframes, put it together with Balsamiq, all of the key pages, templates, showing content and functionality, then maybe Photoshop some stuff together as a style indicator. This is how their digital department works, that they're just getting it off the ground. We are often finding that clients are not fully understanding our project proposals and specs from them with the wireframes and specs we present. Some ask for every page mocked up in Photoshop so they can understand or visualize from the wireframes what's going on, to approve the wireframes. Then we want to start changing the core functionality or design features after development has started, and that gets tough. We try to work from a fixed price quote, and this makes it hard for that because, you know, there's a lot of back and forth and stuff. So do we have any advice for Dave on getting their digital department off the ground as far as you know, getting approval, and is their workflow already outdated or what? I don't know.
Karen, any thoughts?
So I think the problem you're describing there is a very common one. I think everybody who gets their feet wet in digital goes through that process. And I think the skills that you need to develop as an organization are really on the account management and client management side. Like, you need people who can explain how digital works and why digital doesn't work the same way as print advertising, for example. And it's tough. I think it's especially tough for people who are coming out of traditional advertising and marketing because they're used to working a certain way. I also do a lot of work with traditional publishers, and it's, you know, and in a lot of ways it's the same problem, different side of the coin, where you have people who are just very accustomed to a particular process. They have a value system, they have a culture that is all rooted in working one way, and now you need to tell them that it doesn't work that way on the web. And you're not going to solve that problem without having clear and dedicated advocates for how the web is different. And if in your organization, all of those, if, you know, if all of your account managers, client manager people are coming out of print and they don't understand how web is different, then you're going to wind up in a world of hurt with those fixed price contracts. So I would just try to educate yourself about, you know, it's like when people in the web space talk about their workflow being different, where they talk about structuring contracts differently, when they talk about agile methods or why they don't do particular types of deliverables, you should figure out why they're saying that, because it's probably that they've spent the last 10 years in the same kind of pain that you've been in, and they taught themselves how not to do that.
Nice.
I feel like we need a Karen McGrain hotline that just calls Karen and gets the right answer to every question.
So some of it is client education is a big part of it. And, you know, Dave, if you haven't seen Samantha Warren's Style Tiles, that might be interesting to you too. So it's kind of like, hey, client, the first step here is for us to kind of agree upon some, assuming that you're in the business of somebody calls you up and you need a website and you're making it from scratch and you're deciding upon, you know, visuals and how you're going to approach stuff and stuff. If the design is a big part of it, you might want to check out Style Tiles, because I think that might be interesting, where you educate them ahead of time that what you're going to be showing them is a feeling, as a, you know, you're deciding upon colors and font styles and stuff and what those feel like. Maybe that would be could help you out. Not sure. We got one that
you could also try the like rough prototyping code situation, you know, if you're just saying like, you know, when you're talking deliverables, you, instead of a Photoshop mock for everything, what if I gave you some, you know, rough sketched HTML or something? They might agree to that. They might feel like that is a step down the path to having a website, so they might agree to that. That was my only addition.
I like it.
Okay.
What was I going to say? I think you just added one here at the bottom.
I just added one. We got a last minute question from Cameron Ornelas writing in. Karen, what is your opinion on websites, business class websites that is, that use large sliders on the landing page? Do you feel this is a waste of website real estate or a powerful instrument to convey an idea? Why I ask this question, I'm seeing more often websites are using large images on a landing page to deliver the basic idea of what the company or business does. I feel they do not accomplish anything or do anything other than fill in where poor content strategy was put in place. Lastly, what strategies would you use to help navigate away from slider development? So this is kind of a compound thing, right? So large sliders, good or bad.
So when you say large sliders, do you mean like a carousel?
I think the carousel, yeah, like the big hero unit carousel.
That rotates.
And then he's saying like I see people using these like big, large images with a little bit of text, you know, is that a good content strategy as well? And then what the third part is, what strategies would you use in replacement of like big carousels?
Brad Frost has a quote that carousels exist to keep people from beating the crap out of each other in meetings. And I think it's true. It's like the carousel's not there to support the user's goals. The carousel is there to support the internal organization's goals of having everybody feel like they've got their thing on the page. So that's not an easy one to solve. I mean, I think that you can understand what's going on in those meetings where people are going to start beating each other up if they don't get to have their thing featured the way they want it featured. So if someone finally says, I know, we'll make it a carousel, and then you guys can all be equal. I find that mobile is actually a great catalyst for helping to have some of these conversations. Like, I do an exercise in one of my workshops where I give them some pages, and I give them some desktop pages, and I say, okay, I want you to go through this page, and I want you to cross out everything that you don't think needs to be on mobile. And then the stuff you want to keep, I want you to give me some notes about why it's valuable, how you think it's structured in the CMS, that kind of thing. And it's amazing how easy it is for people to go in and just, you know, start crossing out images, crossing out a bunch of, you know, giant, like there's a bunch of crap on the page that isn't actually providing a whole lot of value. It's just there to take up space or kind of decorate the page. And people are very comfortable being like, oh no, let's get rid of all of this stuff. And I'm fond of saying it's like content, you know, performance is a content strategy problem. I think people do so much work to try to like squeeze the last little, you know, K out of their code. And it's like, why don't you just take one of those giant images off the page? It's not providing any value. And look there, your performance just, you know, went up 100-fold. So I think that these kind of conversations are not easy ones to have, and they're very political. And, you know, when you're going in there, you have to understand you are essentially telling someone in the organization that their stuff isn't as important as they think it is. And that is a political hit for them. And so those conversations have to be handled delicately. But if you can wave a tiny little smartphone screen in their face and say, so tiny, can't fit it all, must remove some things, and convince them that there's your chance to take some of the images off, that can make for a better experience, not just on mobile, but on the desktop too.
Interesting. I want to find out what you think about like these large image format sites, but Chris, I think we should do another sponsor.
Oh, gosh, dang it. I'm going to give them a discount on this one. Sorry. I always do this. But it's worth hearing about. It's the Artifact Conference. Literally the URL is artifactconf.com. It is in Providence, Rhode Island, about an hour outside of Boston. Dave's going to be there talking about stuff, the kind of the general vibe of it. And Ooh. It's put on by Environments for Humans plus Genville, who's awesome.
Yes.
The vibe of it is kind of a lot about what we've been talking about today. This kind of how do we deal with multiple devices, just because there's no end to needing to talk about this more, because it's just it's mega important and it's affecting all of our lives, both, you know, as our jobs and because we have these devices and we use it and the internet is awesome. So go check it out. Right? What else do we have to say about it? There's some workshops at it that are pretty cool. It's kind of the traditional in person. You go there and have a good time. I bet the party is going to be at a bar. Ooh, hashtag drama.
This was a very special conference to me. I just think it had such a cool feel. So I'm looking forward to going again. You should go totally. I mean, it's going to be good. I'm going to be talking about responsive images, which, if you haven't been following along, is pretty hot right now. So there you go. If you needed a reason to go. Anyway, back to the show, Karen. So what, like these large format image sites, do you know what I'm talking about? I'm trying to think of like a good example. I don't know. Apple.com.
Yeah.
Is it
huge, giant, heavy images? Yeah.
just a big image that's like, or like Apple actually rotates, but like if it was just like a static thing, is that a good strategy, or is that just like phoning it in? You're just like, hey, don't know what to do. Image done.
I think kind of across the board, when I look at the mobile, the, you know, the problems that we have with mobile, with like publishing, you know, true multi-channel publishing, those problems are hard and we're going to have to give them some attention. And I personally believe that for organizations to adapt their, what they're publishing and what their workflow is for publishing, in the interim, like in the next couple, 2, 3, 5 years, I think we just really need to focus on getting that right, because that's, it's going to mean a lot of changes. And so if you have to make a sacrifice of saying, well, what we'd love to have on the desktop is this giant image because we know we can do that, but our workflow won't support like having that giant image on the desktop and then figuring out what else we're going to do on mobile, sacrifice the giant image. Like, just do, you know, just accept. Like, let's, our goal right now is to do the best possible job we can across every platform, even if it means that we're not doing the optimal job on any one given platform. And that, you know, that to me, that's a philosophy that extends way beyond, you know, the big image, you know, having one big image. It's sort of like you may have to make some compromises about how you would like to do this one thing, so in the greater service of a better experience on every platform. But, you know, to the images point, I do a lot of work with publishers, and traditional publishers already have a workflow for multiple crop sizes. Like they have that built in because they have to use their images in lots of different contexts, and people haven't really, that is not a workflow that exists for a lot of web publishers. So if you were thinking like a hotel client, all of the work that something that you might do on the responsive images front needs to be supplemented with another workflow on the content side, on the editorial side, where they may need to be cropping different images. But more than that, even their photo workflow might need to be different. They may need to be giving their photographers different instructions about what types of images to cut. Because a hotel room, it's like, you go in and you can't just like crop different sizes of it. You can't just squish it down. You may need to be actually shooting different images. And so that to me says, oh, right. Like when you really look at this problem, we might have to make some compromises. And that seems like one where we should all be saying, hey, let's try to figure out what the sanest possible thing we can do with images is, because it's going to be a bitch to figure out. And one of those things that might be really sane is, okay, let's just drop the giant images. They're not going to work across platform.
Cool. That's a pretty solid advice. I'm trying to find like examples I really like, you know, and because that actually helps me more than like finding examples I hate or whatever. it's more rewarding for me. But you know, the Event Apart site or something like that, they have a big graphic, but it's like a link to the latest conference or the next upcoming conference. Or a Book Apart is the same thing. It's like a link to the latest book. I think that just is very that's very good and useful. I think if you can make that hero unit thing useful, it works. But if it's just a picture of, I don't know, somebody using a phone, it's maybe not as useful.
Clearly.
I don't know.
Good design is good design. I don't know. You know, like I've seen them in the past where it's good. Like how to make chocolate, and the slider is a 1 through 10 step of it, and it's like totally appropriate and useful. And but when it's, yeah, when it's the, you know, with the person with the headset on looking at a fake computer screen, you're like, okay, I wouldn't even call that a sacrifice to get rid of it. But I do like the sentiment that you need to sacrifice things sometimes for the sake of performance and usability and such.
I think we all know the difference between an image that is meaningful and provides value and, you know, a picture of somebody wearing a headset in a call center. like these debates, they get a lot easier when you actually sit somebody down and say, okay, let's look at the images on this page. Which ones would you get rid of? People are like, oh, I'm getting out my red pen and I'm just going to cross this off because I don't need it.
Indeed.
Cool. Awesome. Well, I think we're over time. So, Karen, gotta thank you very much for coming on to the Shop Talk Show. If people aren't already following you or anything like that, how do people follow you, give you money, buy your products? How does that work?
They should follow me on Twitter. I am conveniently Karen McGrain, both on Twitter and in real life.
I use that system as well.
It works better. And people can visit my website at bondartscience.com. There's a contact form there if anybody wants to ask me how they can give me money.
Indeed.
Perfect. And buy your book.
And they should buy my book at abookapart.com, Content Strategy for Mobile.
And every time you buy a book on A Book Apart, a Zeldman gets its wings. Hey, I'm delirious. Hey, thanks everyone for listening, subscribing, doing all that, how you do that. Be sure to follow us at Shop Talk Show. Thanks, Chat Room, for coming out. We really appreciate it. We still have a store, shoptalkshow.com/store. And Chris, am I leaving anything out?
I don't know. I like the idea of asking people to rate us up on iTunes, but only if you give us a 5. If we're interested in your real feedback, but if you have actual feedback, you should email it to us because then we'll read it. But so we're not interested in your actual feedback on iTunes. We're just interested in asking.
We just want to look cool. Well, those ratings actually help people find the show and listen to the show. Like they help it kind of exist in the iTunes ecosystem. And actually, we have a 5-star rating with quite a few number of reviews. So we really appreciate reviews.
You know, feedback of any kind is great. Anyway,
but if you do have feedback, just go to the question form and send it in. Thanks.
ShopTalkShow.com.
Ta-da.